Today is Friday, April the 13th. Who better to join us than Interim Fire Chief Bill Reynolds. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. How are you today?
Good, good. You're flying black and orange, but it's not the San Francisco variety.
No. I'm wearing my University of the Pacific Tigers hat in honor of my daughter. She's coming home today and get to see her for the weekend.
So. Oh, very cool. Very cool. So, but we're not going to talk about what they're going to do this weekend. We're going to talk about things that we all need to be doing in the next couple of weeks or so. I suppose, Bill, this is the time, you know, we've got all the spring flowers are out. Things are happening, planning, et cetera, et cetera. And a little bit of landscaping as well. I know there was a big push last fall about defensible space.
Correct.
Okay. Do we need to worry about that inside city, you know, inside Eureka, inside Arcata, inside of Fortuna? Does that really factor in much?
You know, it does. It factors in everywhere. You know, we tend to focus on it in the rural communities where wildfire is a big concern. But these fires do happen inside the city of Eureka in particular. We have a lot of areas that are bordered by green belts and where we have the vegetation impinging on properties. So we don't tend to see the larger scale vegetation fires they do like they do in the wide open areas. But it is an issue in our area.
So what are some of the steps that regular guy, regular gal, in a regular home, somewhere inside of a community. What do we look at? You know, I mean, if you have the trimming and the ornamentals, okay, you're going to be shaping and keeping it kind of as it is. But beyond that kind of stuff, what do you see that causes you pause as you're driving around town?
The biggest things I see, a lot of cases are berry briars. People have, you know, maybe a neighboring property or a property nearby that has berry briars, and those tend to dry out very fast. And I can tell you from experience, when those are dried out enough and they burn, they go like gasoline. They're pretty darn quick. Other things are, we have, you know, obviously we're blessed with beautiful trees and vegetation in our area. You know, not just the redwoods, but other trees and, you know, overhanging branches that are hanging over roofs and fences and then trying to get people to you know, obviously it takes a little bit more elbow grease sometimes to remove those things than just the regular berry briars and bushes. But you know, try and encourage people to make sure that they have that defensible space, you know, in town here as well.
There's not an awful lot of the ornamental oaks and maples and stuff that drop leaves. I know we got one, but I'm not sure how many other have those. Are leaves an issue? Is it the dead branches on the trees that are the issue? Is it just the tree itself that's an issue? What do you see when you see some of these trees that a lot of us go ooh and ah about? Are you guys also oohing and aahing, or do you see potential there for fire to kind of run along those plants?
Yeah, I think both. You know, I love the, you know, obviously I live in this area for a reason, you know, born and raised, but also the, you know, the natural beauty of the area is perfect. And part of that is the trees. But I also, you know, tend to look at it as a firefighter, and I see fuel when I see that. And one of the biggest things that I see, especially in the urban setting, is the tree litter, what they call it, basically the dropping of the leaves, you know, pine needles and whatnot. And those can all be considered, you know, ladder fuels to get, you know, a smaller fire going that could potentially progress to the larger fuels, such as the tree itself and potentially structures, fences and outbuildings and houses themselves.
I was going to ask you about the Monterey pines. I just absolutely, you know, we grew up, had a dozen of them or so in the backyard. Absolutely abhor those things. And, you know, they grow like weeds, which is why they're here. Okay. In addition to a couple developers really enjoying them or in the 60s and sticking them all over the place. But the duff, if it was a redwood tree, I don't know what you call it, if it's a pine tree, the needles and stuff that are down around, are those as dried out? Are they as tender, I guess would be the right word, as like dead leaves? I mean, do they burn the same way? Do they burn just as quickly? Different species, different things, but are they similar?
They can. Basically, we normally see that, and if there's a large accumulation of them, if it's just a relatively small, sparse amount, obviously they would burn very quickly, but they wouldn't have enough time to generate the heat, obviously, to be a fuel that's going to spread to something else. But where we see it is a lot, if you have an area that's, you know, if we have a dry year, and we've had a year where a lot of that needle litter has dripped into, say, gutters on houses. And if for whatever reason, you know, if something were to catch on that, you know, you could potentially see it being just as dangerous as the other types you were mentioning.
rhododendrons, azaleas, things like that, eh.
Yeah. You know, again, they could cause a potential threat, but only if they're in a large enough quantity. Typically, stuff like that's not the stuff we tend to
rhodies don't drop leaves, and they're always tend to be, I mean, it's really, unless it's dead.
Right.
You can't really crinkle a rhododendron leaf.
Right.
Yeah,
so not as much of a concern. You know, the big ones that, like I said earlier, like I see around town, or when I see, when I drive down an alley, or I drive past the residence where I see a large berry briar that's kind of overtaken a fence, or in some cases, areas outside the city where I've seen berry briars that have overtaken houses, those really cause me some pause because, again, those things are going pretty quick and they generate a lot of heat and they can sustain it for just enough time to cause us some real problems.
You mentioned fences also. A lot of us have fences. A lot of us have different design fences. You know, we've got railroad ties. I don't know if a railroad tie would burn. I mean, it's got enough creosote in it. I don't think it's going to go anywhere.
Right.
But you know, some of the older redwood fences, some of the drier woods that are there. Do fires run along fence? Or
yeah.
Is there, I mean, there's enough material there for it to be able to catch and continue, so to speak?
Yeah, it's actually a pretty common call that we get. When we, you know, if we get a call for a fence on fire, we typically, if it's attached to a residence, we'll dispatch a full structure fire response to that because it can sustain the burning enough and ladder to the building pretty darn easily. So we take it pretty serious. And in our area, too, we see, you know, fence fires relatively commonly, not just from, a mistake from a homeowner, say, burning too close to a fence, but also people dropping cigarettes and whatnot. So we
catch the grass runs the fence, and
absolutely
then up the fence.
Absolutely.
Boy, that would tee me off if I had a redwood fence and that's what happened. Let's look for lip prints. Okay, fine. It's 8:19.
Listen to 980 AM for the best music, ABBA, Neil Diamond, Barbra Streisand, Billy Joel, and the Fifth Dimension. The all-time best are heard every day, all day long on 980 AM. We are easy radio, easy on your ears and easy on your mind. This is memory-making music and you'll love the memories you create. Tune in and hear the best music, easy radio, 980 AM.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:24. We're back to Talk Shop this morning with Interim Fire Chief for Humble Bay, Billy Reynolds. One of the things that I think is neat about our area, one of the things that I would suspect is a concern for you, is fireplaces. I mean, to me, that's part of having a house is having a fireplace. Not the Ben Franklin wood stove thing, and I am still partial to wood instead of gas.
Same.
Okay. Probably will eventually go to the gas model, but you see a lot of wood piles around houses, next to houses, sometimes leaning against houses.
Yes, yes.
I would suspect that that's a awe-inspiring moment for you because wood does burn.
Absolutely.
But are fire stacks sources, or do they just tend to kind of compound? I can't ever recall a news or a press release from you guys saying, and so-and-so was smoking next to the wood pile, next to the house, and it caught the house on fire.
Right.
I don't think those words have ever come together in 45 years of being out here. So is it just another element of fuel to add to the fire, just like other things in the garage might be?
Right. And you think about building a campfire or a fire in your fireplace, normally you have to have the newspaper that goes to the kindling that goes to the larger. And typically we don't see that with people outside smoking and that being a big cause of fires outside. Where we do see problems with that, especially in the wildland urban interface where people are living closer to nature, they have a wildland fire that's coming through the area. This is this big abundant fuel source that's right next to their house potentially. And one of the things we're trained to do when we're out, when we get called out to help the state on some of the bigger fires, if we're protecting a structure, that's one of the first things that we look for is moving the readily available fuels away from the structure. And basically we could have a big wood pile that we're spending time throwing that away from the house and trying to get it prepared if the fire is getting ready to pass through. So yeah, it's not typically something that we see here in the city, but you know, especially in the urban setting, that's something we want to get away from the house as quick as we can.
Well, I'd think of termites and spiders and all those things that I don't want them. I don't want them close. I don't want them around me, but you know, there is the convenience also of having it right there.
Right. Yeah. And that's, my grandmother, she lives down in Fort Bragg and she still burns in a wood stove. She's 99 years old. And for someone, in her circumstance, she's going to want to have it as close as possible. But we try to recommend for people is to make sure that if you have some kind of wood storage, try to do it away from your house. So that way, it's going to save you some problems potentially later.
So she's probably got a whole bunch of kindling, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Not dragging in too many of those 4-foot lengths.
No, not these days.
A fireplace. A lot of times we don't think about fireplace and chimney sweeps and that kind of stuff this time of the year. It's kind of the end of the season. We're not going to be burning too much. We'll worry about it in the fall. Wise or not?
I think it's, my preference would be to see basically any time of the year is good for that. But I would think at the end of the season, if you're not going to be burning, I think it's an opportune time to not only have the chimney swept, but also have them look at your chimney to make sure that some of the tremors this season didn't cause any breaches in the chimney. Obviously, that could potentially get into your attic and other places because, as we had, last week, we have a couple of good shakers and, and those could potentially cause, and you don't worry about it for the rest of the season. You forget about those earthquakes that could have potentially caused earthquake damage to that chimney. You go to fire it up at the beginning of next season, not knowing that you had some damage done, and now your attic is on fire.
Okay, fine. So you stole a little bit of my thunder there. with the earthquakes that have happened recently. I was standing, I think I've said this one 3 times now. Standing at the front door here of the studios, I couldn't feel it. Winston was in here. He felt it. A couple of the sales folks felt it in that part of the building, came running out of the building.
Right.
With a 4 or 5, who cares, right? But nonetheless, for some of those earthquakes that don't register with us as being significant, okay, doesn't mean that there's not damage.
Correct.
How do you suggest we go through our houses then? What are we looking for? What are we smelling for? What are we hearing or listening for to make sure that, while things didn't fall off the shelf, something else didn't happen?
Right. I typically, and this isn't scientific by any stretch, but if I have, in my personal house or in my office down at the fire station, if I have stuff that's an earthquake that's strong enough to move things on shelves, topple things, I'm basically going to start doing an assessment of looking for obvious damage, obviously, looking for things like, broken windows, looking for obvious structural damage. But then the other thing you mentioned, smelling, one of the biggest things would be utilities. Do I smell gas, inside or outside? Do I think this was strong enough to basically drop power lines outside? Because we talk about drop, cover, and hold, and then eventually if you think you need to evacuating. But if you're, if this is a strong enough earthquake where you're going to be evacuating, is your exit path safe? Is it, are there power lines that could potentially be down or other hazards that could be presented there? So those are some things I think about there. But the biggest ones I think about, again, are the utilities outside. Because, again, is it going to make it so the egress from the building is going to be compromised in some way?
Yes. Hot water heaters, things of that nature. How do you suggest we approach? Obviously, you're not going to do it with an open flame,
right?
Unless you have never experienced what an open flame and gas could be,
right? Approaching it as far as I think about relying pilot lights or whatnot.
Say the pilot lights out, the hot water heater's a little bit off balance, but it was strapped in properly, so it's. Yeah, things you can tell something happened, but you're really not sure how much or if it was significant enough to worry about.
I'm always going to err on the side of safety. And if you have any doubt at all, if you look at it and you have that gut feeling that it may have gotten moved or displaced by the earthquake, call for PG&E. They're the experts. They can come out and they can evaluate what happened and they can tell you yay or nay. Because if we're, you know, if you're not sure, but you say, I'm going to go take a shower. I need to get the hot water going again here. That could be a mistake in the respect that, you know, it can be a small leak, but over time it can become something where it accumulates and then you have a problem later. So always err on the side of caution and call PG&E.
KINS, not the fire department. KINS, News and Information Times, 8:30.
What do we do as a community to make Humboldt a better place to work and live? The answer is to make sure our kids are literate, able to plan financially, move forward in their education so they are better prepared to enter our workforce, and become contributing and productive members in our society, community, and economy. How do we do it? Through the Decade of Difference Initiative. Visit decadeofdifference.org and find out how you, as a parent, student, or business owner, can help. It's the Decade of Difference. Be part of it.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:35. We're back to talk shop this morning with Interim Fire Chief Bill Reynolds from Humboldt Bay Fire. Talk shop presented by CDH Painting, by Redeck, by American Ag Credit, and Lolita Cheese Company. Bill, looking at this time of the year, we all kind of get a little bit of an itch to hit the road. Now, I know when you say firefighter, they're not saying medical aid responder.
True.
You're a fire guy. Okay. But you have other areas of expertise and other areas of training. What are some of the things, if someone is planning either a spring break run, or let's say it's that time of the year and they're going to be taking a family vacation this time of the year, what are some of the do's? What are some of the don't do's?
You know, I'm a planner. I think that comes from my nature of being a firefighter, and have a good plan of knowing where you're going, understanding the routes you're going to be taking, and that involves road conditions and what the weather is going to look like, and planning and driving accordingly. Vehicle maintenance is a big deal. Obviously, you want to make sure your knowledge of your vehicle seaworthy, so to speak, and ready to go. But you also want to make sure that if you're going to be going to areas where there's going to be potentially still snow on the road, some of the colder areas, make sure you're appropriately, have chains and whatnot. Also, the other thing too is it's always helpful to, if you're going someplace, especially if you're going solo, let family know the way you're going to be going. So if for some reason you're going to lose contact, they actually have an idea of the route you're going to be taking. And again, leave yourself enough time for weather. We all want to get to the destination. You know, usually the road trip, the best part's the destination where you get to the fun activity or wherever you're going. But make sure you allot yourself enough time to, if you were to see some delays and everything, you're not trying to push yourself to drive a little bit faster than you should. So.
Now, hypothermia, we hear about an awful lot from the coasties, in the water.
Right.
Okay. And we know you got 25 minutes roughly in the water and then you're in trouble. What about hypothermia? Okay, car breaks down somewhere. There's snow on the ground, but it's like, 30, 40 degrees, something like that. So maybe it's over one of the passes after a storm comes through. How long before things start happening?
It varies from person to person. Obviously, when we talk about hypothermia, if you're a relatively healthy human being, if you have, fuel left in your car and you can run the heater and everything, you're probably going to be okay. Where we start seeing it being a problem is especially with the elderly and with children. And it could be not a whole lot of time before somebody starts feeling the effects of being hypothermic in the vehicle.
So what is that? I mean, you just kind of start feeling cold, teeth chattering. I mean, some of that stuff we do when we're walking the beach.
Right. Initially, those are the signs. Where you really need to start being worried about it is when they stop feeling those signs and symptoms, the chattering teeth, the shivering. When your body starts to get into deeper hypothermia, you stop feeling that coldness. You stop having those reactions to it because the shivering itself is your body's reaction trying to warm itself up. when your body stops trying to warm itself, you know you've got a problem. So it's probably gotten beyond the point where you actually need medical intervention at that point. So, and the key thing with anything like that, like we talked about a little bit ago, is just making sure you don't get yourself into a situation like that. But if you do find yourself traveling in those areas, have a contingency as far as, if you're going to be traveling through areas where that's going to be cold and there's potential snow on the ground.
Let's say your daughter, instead of visiting you, is visiting a buddy in the Midwest. So
right.
She's driving from Stockton over the hills, over the dales, through the snow areas, et cetera, et cetera. What would you recommend for her to take with her? And if there is an issue, other than call dad
right.
and mom, what else, how could she best protect herself in that kind of a situation? Because that's good through July.
Absolutely. And this could go even through the, like you said, non-cold months. But we talk about with earthquake preparedness, having a 72-hour kit, having something that you have in your house to basically see you through the first 72 hours of the emergency, very much akin to what I would recommend for traveling distances like that. Have a kit in your car where not only do you have the typical things to, put out if you go pull over to the side of the road to warn other traffic, but I would have, obviously jackets and blankets. I would think about, some water, some food. So basically, if you were to find yourself stuck and you had to basically wait a couple of days, you would be able to have something to help kind of get you through the stuff like, the coldness and everything till you could potentially find help. So
not relying on your cell phone?
Especially in our area, there's some areas that I drive through and it still amazes me that we don't have cell phone coverage there. But as you get, to some of the more rural areas, those areas exist. So, and not only that, going back to the whole being a planner thing, having a contingency that I know if for some reason, my cell phone's not working and I were to get stuck or my vehicle disabled, what my backup plan might be. Part of that is letting somebody know the route you're taking. And so that way, if you don't show up at a scheduled time within a reasonable amount of time, when they should come looking for you.
Well, I'm thinking with some of the switchbacks and stuff, there are ravines that if something happened, let's say you're looking, getting ready to take a picture and all of a sudden, you slip for whatever reason or it gives way. And you're now down in a ravine.
Right.
Okay. Now you're separated. You may have your stuff, but it's up the hill.
Right.
Your cell phone isn't working. Game on.
Yeah.
It's a whole different dynamic. We'll talk about that when we come back. KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:43.
The Redwood Region Economic Development Commission and Fly Humboldt remind you that flying local is buying local and supports local jobs and investment. Fly Humboldt is a community-based coalition of businesses, organizations, and citizens dedicated to getting more flights to more destinations. We know that reliable and affordable air service is a critical part of a healthy community. For more information, visit flyhumboldt.org or find us on Facebook.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:45. We're back to Talk Shop this morning with Bill Reynolds. Bill, in our little scenario here, as we're getting ready for travel season, we get into a situation where the cell phone isn't working for one reason or another, and we're separated from our vehicle that we may or may not have planned for properly. I think the most frustrating thing would be to have an RV. It's all loaded, and now you can't get to it, and you know that it's there and all that, but you can't get there. What are some of the things for an individual to do at that point to make it through?
The first thing is self-assessment. Am I injured? If you've fallen down a ravine or something of that nature, making sure that doing a quick systems check to see, am I injured and what can I do? The other thing is knowing your own capabilities. For someone like myself, is this something that I can reasonably climb back up and safely without, potentially wanting to, without potentially hurting myself by doing it? And at that point, you need to make an assessment as far as most of the time in situations like this, they preach stay in place. Make a lot of noise, make yourself known as best you can, because if somebody sees this vehicle to the side of the road, if CHP were to pull over and see it over there, make it loud and you're staying in place, because the old theory is if you start wandering off and you are wandering off in the wrong direction, you could be making the job a lot harder on people that are coming to look for you.
So, as well as getting yourself in a tougher spot.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, and in a rural setting like that, you know, again, you know, you're just a broken ankle away from being in a really bad spot. So, my recommendation would be stay in place and make a lot of noise, unless you're know yourself well enough to know you're capable of climbing out of something like that.
I know you're going to love this one. What about a small fire? Smoke, something to get people's attention that way. I mean, containing it so it's not going to start a wildfire.
Right.
But, you know, doing what you need to do, not necessarily for warmth, but that might be part of the equation also. If you're dressed like either of us are, boom, okay, now you're going to overnight.
Right.
Uh-oh. Yeah, maybe you're fortunate enough and you have matches on you somewhere. So you have that ability to start a fire. Yes, no, maybe?
I think so. I think that obviously if you're stuck in a spot where you could potentially be overnight and you have the means to start a fire and you can do it safely, obviously with the appropriate clearance and everything, I think that it's a good idea. Because that way, if you're planning for the worst and you do have to sleep on the ground overnight, you at least have that sense of warmth and the and some sort of a signal there. And you can safely put out the fire. If you were to be rescued or somebody was to come get you, obviously you'll put that out before you go. The last thing you want to do is if you are going to be staying, you know, overnight in a location, is trying to deal with that, you know, at O-Dark 30 when it's, you know, pitch black out and you're already cold. And at that point, it might already be too late. So I think it's a good idea.
But everything in moderation?
Absolutely. And just making sure that, you know, the last thing you want to do is start a small fire like that and set the whole hillside on fire, because that presents a whole lot of different challenges for not only you, but the people that are, you know, coming to respond to the fire.
That's right. If it gets out of hand, now you got to move.
Absolutely. And, you know, and your salvation at the top of the hill, that vehicle may now be at risk, because as the fire burns, it burns uphill. And now you've potentially taken out your transportation out of the area. So
what about water? You know, I know this is more like a hunting show at this point, but you know, you got water going by. Drink it or don't drink it?
You know, that's a tough one. I'm not a survival expert, and at the end of the day, if I would probably hold off on doing that until I got to the point where it was dire enough that, you know, it was either, you know, drink and suffer the consequences later or die. I would probably hold off until I knew it was absolutely necessary, just to be safe. But at the end of the day, you know, water is going to be the big killer out in those situations. And you can only last, I believe, 3 days without water. So at some point, you're going to have to make that decision to take that risk.
As an extended, yeah. When people are searching, you guys don't have search and rescue, but I know you're involved in those at times. What do you look for? Is it broken twigs and things of that nature? Is it the shiny object? Is it the little smoke, wisps of smoke? What are some of those real quick things people could do?
All of the above. And the other thing, if you have pieces of clothing that say, you know, that you can rip and tie to trees and kind of marking your path. Some people, when they go hiking, they carry flagging with them, so they can kind of mark their trail. So those are really good things.
Oh, the Hansel and Gretel without the food.
There you go.
I understand that one. Thanks for coming by, bud. See everybody on Monday.